This week on Thingamabob.
Stay tuned for more.
Baseball bats and gallon cowboy hats and more. Magic rings and other nerdy things in store. Listen on in, it's time for Thingamabob. Better tune in, it's time for Thingamabob.
Thingamabob!
Well, hello, Brie.
Well, hello, Josh.
Hello, everybody listening.
And welcome to Thingamabob.
This week's theme is just movie soundtrack things.
Just movie soundtrack things.
It really flows off.
Yay. Josh and I love movie soundtracks.
We've been dreaming about this theme. And the funny part about this theme is that, like, I've been dreaming about it because I love, like, movie soundtracks, so we both do.
Mm-hmm.
Love them so much, listen to them constantly. And in a weird way, it's like, so this should have been like, I mean, it's a little early. Should have been like, you know, an 100 episode for me. You know, I would have all this stuff and da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
But like in my favorites, in the terms of movie soundtracks, like the ones that I kind of like, where like, da-da-da, I'm going to look it up a little bit. The information just wasn't what I wanted.
Okay.
So it's like, at the end of the day, like, I really wanted this to be, like, oh, my God, like, my favorite soundtrack ever. I get to gush about it for an hour. And instead, I kind of picked one that's, like, an iconic one, but not my favorite. So it's, like, it's kind of a weird thing here, but...
Yeah. Mine is probably one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But this gives us a perfect opportunity to talk a little bit right now about some of our favorite movies and movie scores, given that we might not be covering them for the actual episode content. Would you like to start, Joshua?
Sure. What I would have liked to do was Spirited Away.
What wasn't there for Spirited Away?
Any real information about Joe Hisaishi?
Mm.
It was, you know, I like looked up like interviews or things like that, but it was about other movies,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily about Spirited Away. Or if it was about Spirited Away, it just wasn't really there. And then I looked up like Miyazaki interview about Joe Hisaishi.
Yeah.
And that wasn't very, like, good or whatever. And then I looked at, Googled it, and it's just, like, the soundtrack and about behind Spirited Away itself.
Okay.
Not behind the music of Spirited Away, which is just such an important, iconic part of mm-hmm. Spirited Away.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, what was there just wasn't interesting.
That's so interesting, because I do... It wasn't interesting. That's so interesting. it's interesting because I feel like the music is such an important part of Miyazaki films that there would be more on the composer or the process or...
And their collaboration, which has been so long-standing. Like, every film that Miyazaki has done besides one mm-hmm. is composed by Joe.
Right.
Joe.
Our good friend Joe.
Japanese name is... You know, so it's like, yeah, you know.
Sure,
so just
sure,
like,
yeah. I mean, to be fair, I'm doing a movie series scored by John Williams, which there wasn't like, I at least chose not to focus too much on like his life and sort of just talked about the influence of the movies, but there was more information there, so.
And I will say that in my opinion, and probably a lot of people's opinions,
mm-hmm.
John Williams is the greatest film composer of all time.
Yeah.
And has the most recognizable themes out of, like, any composer.
Yeah, that was part of my research, which I'll touch on, like, a little bit later. But I think one of the articles I read was, like, John Williams single-handedly ushered in the golden age of film scoring. And he's not technically wrong.
Right.
Like, it was kind of, yeah, John Williams has... an insane, what do you call it? Not archive.
Anthology?
Anthology of films. Like, when I looked it up, I think he's done over 75 film scores. And, like, dozens of those have been iconic.
Yeah.
Which is hard to literally, when you think accomplish.
About, when you think about, like, the Jaws theme, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or Indiana Jones theme, yeah. you know, it's just, like, those stick with you.
There was a really interesting interview that I listened to done by the BBC with John Williams kind of about that, about, like, well, what was your process? Because Jaws is only, like, two notes. How did you come up with something
right,
like that?
Right.
And he was like, oh, well, you know, I was sort of inspired by the idea of the single note in Psycho. That's, like, very, like, wee. Mm. It's just interesting to hear him talk about it. It didn't relate too much to what I'm doing today. Mm-hmm. But I think I did link it in my in the show notes of, like, things that I referenced. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go listen to that, it's, like, 20 minutes long. It's very interesting. It's John Williams talking about a bunch of his scores and, like, how he comes up with these things.
So. And I think what's interesting, too, about, like, film composers is, one, that they do it after the film is made.
Mm-hmm, you know, which I didn't really realize.
It's rare that a collaboration exists while the film is happening. Mm-hmm. It's, like, it's post-production stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what is interesting, it's true about my composer, too, is that, like, these people, they're doing a job mm-hmm. at the end of the day. You know, you don't write the Jaws theme thinking, oh my God, this is going to be one of the most iconic pieces I've ever made. It's like, no, like, what fits the theme? Like,
right.
What fits the vibe of the movie tells the story the best.
Right,
like,
creates a mood, whatever.
And the directors, you know, especially Steven Spielberg, mm-hmm. has such a hand in how those movies are created.
Yeah.
And how the music is created. Yeah. And the composer will come and tell, you know, Steven Spielberg, hey, this is the idea for what I have here. And Steven Spielberg might be like, nah, I don't really like that. Can we do something more like, you know, like this?
Yeah. You know what I read that's so interesting is that a lot of the time a director will edit their movie to like a sample backing track. So it's like this is not going to be the final music, but this is just like
the
an
vibe.
Idea to keep in mind of the vibe. And apparently what happens a lot is that a director will edit with that sort of feeling in mind. And then when they go to the composer, they don't like any of the new stuff that's given to them because they've become attached
to the
sample music. So a lot of the time, the scores for movies will end up being built off of the sample songs that they edited to.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because they do kind of need something. And I talk about this a lot, is that music is really instrumental in creating a specific emotional response to things.
Right.
And I imagine it makes it much easier for a director to cut together their movie with a musical motif or idea in mind. So, of course, they get attached to it.
Yeah.
It was just, it's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's, not to like keep harping on it, but there was this is going to be a loose, rough quote.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess when he sat down to watch Schindler's List with Steven Spielberg,
mm-hmm.
John Williams was like so moved by it and was like, oh gosh, I don't know what to do. And I think he said to Steven Spielberg, you know, you have to get a better composer than I am to score this film.
Wow.
And Steven Spielberg was like, I know, but they're all dead. That's like the rough idea of like this movie is so good that you need the literal best composer in the world. And John Williams is a very humble man and was like, it's not me, it's somebody else.
Right.
But they're all dead. So it's got to be John Williams because
turns out it is, though, because the Schindler's List theme is also iconic.
Yes. I think so. Maybe it won an Oscar. I don't know because I didn't do that movie. So I'm not sure, but it might have.
Probably. Honestly.
I know that John Williams has 5 Oscars for his film scores and is the most nominated person in ever, I think, of all time.
See, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That literally makes sense.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard, too, because, like, this is true for, like, modern composers, actors, directors, and stuff like that, is, like, it's really hard to become the, like, most nominated and the most won because old Hollywood was so small.
Yeah.
That, like, every year the same people and the same people won and it's just like
so
when they do achieve that, it's like so impressive because they did that with thousands of composers that are writing for thousands of movies.
Yeah, and John Williams started like after the age of like the Hollywood studio where they had like one person do all their movies and everything. So
yeah, exactly.
He was sort of already in it.
He was right at he was kind of at the like end.
Yeah, I do. I'll talk about that a little bit because I did, since I'm going first, I wanted to give us like a little precursor on the history of like film scores in general. Mm-hmm. So we'll do like a real quick roundup of how they used to do things and changed it and what we do now. But no, we'll get there eventually.
That is interesting because mine kind of fits in that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the timeline of composing in general.
Oh, my interesting.
Person. But I also want to say one more fun fact before we start.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
Is something I found that like a lot of movies will not have a composer and they'll use like real songs or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I was like, oh, I kind of want to do 2001 A Space Odyssey because that was such an iconic movie, mm-hmm. not thinking that it was all classical music. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that Stanley Kubrick asked Alex North, who is one of the most nominated as well composers of all time, to write the music for it. And he did. And they went to the table and did all the editing and all that kind of stuff. The movie comes out. Alex North goes to the premiere and finds out there that his music was cut.
He didn't know. Oh my God. Because I knew that there was a score written and they were like, no, we're going to use classical music.
Classical music, yeah.
They didn't tell him?
Until the premiere.
That's shady.
Could you imagine? You're like, oh yeah, I wrote the music to this.
So upset.
I would be so upset too.
Oh my God.
Not once was that communicated? What? I mean, I know Stanley Kubrick is like problematic, but it's like, what?
Yeah, we've heard tell. But
I know, but so it's like in that like, at some point directors are like, this doesn't really fit my vision. I'm just going to use classical music.
Yeah.
Well, it's so iconic that it worked. But
that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, one last thing before we really begin. We have a large announcement to make. And I'm going to let Josh do that. Josh, take it away.
We obviously have loved making this podcast. We've been doing it since September 2020, mm-hmm. which has been such a long time. And it's been like something that we've really enjoyed collaborating on and working on and learning a million new things. You know, how many two things smarter are we? but we have decided together to stop and end the podcast because, you know, it's been a lot. Like when mm-hmm. When we started the podcast, we did it with the most free time. Because it was in the middle of the pandemic.
We started in the pandemic and we were both still unemployed.
Right.
And searching for a creative outlet somewhere.
Yeah. And it just became like increasingly hard to work that in with like the regular schedule.
Kind of the more of normal life that came back, the harder it's been. Because it may not seem like it at all times, but there's a lot of work. There's a lot of time. There's a lot of research. That goes into every single episode. And so, you know, obviously, the busier we got with life things, the harder it became to create these episodes. And we want to do just, like, the highest quality possible.
Right.
And it was becoming harder and harder to do that. So
right. We
had a little discussion about how it was time for us to end. And so this is going to be our last regular episode. And then we are going to have one more episode next week where we're going to talk kind of just about the podcast and our favorite moments and memories and I don't know, maybe we're still discussing it, but
A little postmortem,
the history of Thingamabob, I don't know, we're going to figure it out, but there will be one more episode.
Yeah, we wanted to close it off on like a culmination of what we have created in the past year and a half, so... Yeah, it's just going to be about Thingamabob things. We've had a lot of fun, but we really got to run. So, yeah.
Yeah. So that's that. That's that announcement.
But enjoy this episode.
Enjoy the episode. This one will be normal.
Normal.
Yeah. let's jump into it.
Let's.
All right. So I'm going to talk today about the Harry Potter scores, specifically focusing on movies 1 through 3, because those are the ones that John Williams worked on. And then after that, he left the project. So there's also 8 movies, and that seemed like too many to talk about.
I will say, I find it surprising that he worked on 3.
Yeah, well, I guess he was kind of in and out because he was like, he was fully in for the first one. Mm-hmm. The second one, he had scheduling conflicts because he was working on Catch Me If You Can at the same time.
Oh.
And so what they ended up doing was, this is like jumping way ahead, but they ended up reusing a lot of the music from the first movie, which also made sense because like the series was new and we wanted to like bring back returning motifs for certain characters and stuff like that. But they had another person come in and sort of like fill in the gaps. But if you listen, or just if you know, if you look up a list, whatever, a lot of the music in one and two are the same. And then he comes back like fully for the third one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to say before Brie begins that like we share such a special moment because Brie's parents, hi Sam and Laura, treated me to like literally, I mean us, but mm-hmm. like me.
I was there. It wasn't just you. Me. But they're like, you we're two taking were there, Josh but, like, and you have to stay
but,
home.
But like also me. To literally one of my favorite moments of my entire life. We went and saw John Williams, Steven Spielberg, like live orchestration concert.
They call it a pops concert when it's not classical music.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just like, it was so special. I just remember weeping the entire time. Oh. It was literally like, I literally can't thank you enough, Sam and Laura, for like what that was. Because like, I know it's like, oh, you know, we're going to a like lovely concert at the Detroit Music Hall. It's going to be like fun or whatever. But to me, it was like, huge and very special, and so thank you. Aww. And I'm glad we got to share that together.
Wow, when they listen, they're gonna be thrilled because I don't think they know that that meant so much to you. I didn't know that that meant so much to you.
I've talked to you and about so, well, it, about no, it being one of my favorite moments.
I know that now. At the time, I didn't know that it right. meant so much to you.
Yeah, I think I did explain it when we were there about how like special it was.
Yeah,
but like genuinely. I can't talk about it enough. It like it still sticks with me as being like such a special moment.
Yeah, it was very cool. It's very yeah. cool to hear all of that live.
Yeah, and the whole yeah. first half was just John Williams doing like all his iconic themes, mm-hmm. and then the second half Steven Spielberg came out and they like had a giant projector and they mm-hmm. like showed what those worked in the Steven Spielberg like how those worked in the movies.
Yeah, they like played the music live while playing the scene like on a projector, right?
Yeah,
right.
And they did a moment, speaking of it without the music, where it was the opening to Last Crusade, mm-hmm. where he's like jumping on the train and stuff like that without the music.
Mm-hmm.
And then they replayed it with the orchestration live to yeah. show you like how the music influenced.
And those
influenced
are some of them. Your favorite movies.
Oh, I love the Indiana Jones movies. They're so weird. Like, why do I like them? I think that's just like an adventure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. And the music is incredible.
That's just really good. Anyway, tell me about him.
I'm going to tell you about Harry Potter. Like I said, before I do, I'm going to give you some general film score history real quick. So, as we all probably know, silent films were the first moving pictures, but they were not actually presented silently. So to provide an underscoring for what was happening in the film, the theaters playing said film would have to provide the music themselves, either from one or several live musicians or playing from a phonograph in the theater. So if the music was live, the musicians would often improvise music that they felt went along with the story, or they would just play popular classical pieces. But in 1929, filmmakers discovered how to synchronize sound to film, and Hollywood studios began to hire their own in-house composers to write music for their movies. And music became like a huge part of films where they would sort of like mimic the movement of the music in the movement of the actors, because films used to be very like physical, slapsticky sort of
very literal
sort of stuff. Very literal, yeah. So composers came from many different backgrounds, although many of them were concert musicians to begin with. And composer Max Steiner took the idea of a leitmotif theme from classical music's Richard Wagner. A leitmotif is a repeating theme heard throughout a piece of music or an opera and is often played when referencing a specific character or a specific moment. So Steiner used this idea for the score of 1933's King Kong, and movies from here on out would like heavily encompass this idea of a leitmotif or a character theme that you hear every time you see that character mm-hmm. or you maybe want to be thinking about that character.
Mm-hmm. And also helps with what's very important about the Harry Potter movies to you, nostalgia.
Yes, exactly.
Because when you hear that, you feel the energy that that movie exudes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the repetition of it sort of helps you, like, the way you felt when you first heard it mm-hmm. gets felt again.
And you can, what I like too is that some composers will play with it, like mm-hmm. maybe make it darker if something's changed, mm-hmm. or they'll repeat the theme in like a different way or spot.
Yeah.
To like, and then you're like, why is that theme there? And yeah. you're like thinking about it.
Yeah. 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 Which I'll mention a little bit later because there's some good little ones in Harry Potter. So movies from here on out, from like the 30s onward, would experiment with a bunch of different sounds, different genres of music. They used a lot of jazz music to move away from the strictly like European sound of the past few years. They used a lot of European classical music. They also began to commission original songs with lyrics for their films in order to both boost sales of movie tickets and records. It was another way to make money.
I mean...
Yep. This became the favored method of scoring movies. As you mentioned earlier, how movies would often, like... What's the word? I wrote it down. They would license, like, popular songs for their movies rather than, like, pay somebody to write a whole new score.
Right.
It became really popular. Oh, especially so in the movie The Graduate, which was sort of like the springboard for this trend, whose whole soundtrack is almost entirely licensed popular songs, except for Simon and Garfunkel's original song, Mrs. Robinson, which went on to become a number one hit after the success of the movie. So studios saw this happening. They're like, oh, wow, we can both generate a lot of attention for the movie through songs like this. And, like, hiring popular artists, which people still do today. And we can sell records and promote the movie through radio plays. And, like, there were all these different benefits to licensing original songs.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. This method of licensing songs was actually cheaper for most studios, too, rather than paying somebody and hiring a whole orchestra and all of that. All the way up until 2017, it was cheaper.
Wow.
I know. And then I guess, I don't know what happened, but it was not cheaper anymore. So it was very popular, but it was not the only approach that was taken to scoring movies, as we know. So by the 50s, the system of the Hollywood movie studio was changing and composers worked more as freelance artists rather than being anchored to one single studio. The 70s saw a rise in the use of synthesizers for music scoring, and despite the cheaper option of licensing songs, the classic method of original scoring rises once more in popularity. And in 1977, John Williams and his score for Star Wars would go on to become the highest-selling non-pop record of all time.
All time.
All time.
To this day.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yep. John Williams, I think I wrote this maybe somewhere else. He'd been writing film scores at this point for like over 10 years already. Mm-hmm. I think his first one was in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
So he had like other hits under his belt. I think Jaws came out before Star Wars. So he was like pretty well known, but Star Wars was the one that like shot him to like golden superstar score status. So after the 70s, movies continued to change with the times, seeing a lot of heavy computer-based sequencing in the 80s and pop culture music references in the 90s, but the classic method of scoring remains popular today, where sort of anything goes as long as it sets the tone and the feeling for the film.
Literally.
Whatever you want. Which brings me to talking about John Williams and Harry Potter.
A match made in heaven.
Yeah, good to me, in my opinion, yes.
It's just so funny, like, it could have been written by someone else.
It could have.
And just thinking about it, it's like, obviously, maybe we would have had different feelings about it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If it was someone else.
But. Well, and technically, it was written by somebody else, because John Williams did the first three, and then it was James Hooper, I think, did 4 and 5, and Alexandre Desplat did the last 2 or 3.
Patrick Doyle?
Oh, maybe it's Patrick 4? Doyle. Yeah, I should have written it down, but because I was focusing on the first three, I was like, I'm not going to talk about it.
I think I only remember that because I was obsessed.
Let me look it up really quick.
With the fourth score. Because I just thought it was so different and weird.
Yeah. It was John Williams, Patrick Doyle, Nicholas Hooper, I had the first name wrong, and Alexandre Desplat.
Mm-hmm.
So... Those are all of the people who collaborated on it. It wasn't just John Williams, but John Williams did the first three.
Right, the ones that are the most recognizable.
The most nostalgic.
Exactly.
Yeah, the ones that are repeated the most, blah, blah, blah. So by the year 2000, John Williams had already won 5 Oscars.
Right,
and had several major hit films under his belt. So he was the natural choice for the soon-to-be multi-movie box office box office smash hit, Harry Potter. The books were already wildly popular. They knew the movies would be successful. So they wanted to bring on like a heavy hitter, big name composer to do music. So director Chris Columbus was set to direct Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And he had previously worked with John Williams on the soundtracks for the Home Alone movies. So they like had a little bit of a working relationship already.
Weird. What a weird connection.
He did Home Alone. Yeah, I know. So Warner Bros. Studios and Christopher Columbus asked Williams to send a sample of what would be the promo music for the movie. So like it might not be in the actual movie, but like what do you think you could do for promo stuff? We just want to see. And the piece that Williams sent ended up being Hedwig's theme, the tinkling music box-esque song so many of us are familiar with. The song perfectly evoked a feeling of magic, excitement, childlike wonder, and intrigue. And I'll play you a clip right now. That's the very opening.
I can't believe that was the first one.
It's the first one. It's the first thing he sent them.
It's in so the movie. Simple, so I guess that makes sense. But yeah. It is very evocative. Yeah. Maybe because it is the nostalgia that's like making me think about it. But like it is kind of like it's mysterious. There's something mysterious about it.
And I love the idea of comparing it to a music box because that is like, I feel like that's not necessarily something that you would look at as like, oh, that's like a magical item. It's like a children's music box.
Right.
But if you're looking at it through the lens of somebody who maybe has never read the books, is seeing this film for the first time, it's a child. It's a story about a child who is discovering something wondrous. And like the idea of a music box being opened up to like that surprise is a very cool idea that I think worked.
Never thought about that.
Perfectly. Yeah. So the opening of the song is played on a solo celesta, which is similar in shape to a piano, but it has a more bell-like sound. This is followed later on in the song, which we can't play all of because of licensing. It's followed by quick-moving violins, harps, and then an eventual takeover of the melody by the brass section. So a lot of the musical choices in the soundtrack seem to harken back to a very old-world sort of sound, which mirrored the wizarding world and its lack of modern technology, its reliance on things like steam engines to get around, and like choices in robes over modern clothing. The whole, it's like almost kind of steampunky, but it's not steampunk. The music sort of tries to evoke this feeling of like, this is like an other, older world. The use of bell-like sounds is repeated in many different compositions throughout Harry Potter's 1-3, and is a theme then carried over by the following composers as a way of tying in the tone and feeling of the music between all 8 films, which I thought was so interesting because I don't think that there is another movie series that is as long as the Harry Potter films. And so it's sort of like the only thing where we've experienced there being, was it 4 different composers and like having to tie in elements from the year 2001 to 2011 and the person or people who are working on it that many years later.
Yeah. And it's their responsibility to create that same sense of wonder that John Williams originally created.
Right. Well, and what's so great and what made it a little easier for them, I think, is that the characters grow with time. So they are changing throughout the stories as well. They are becoming older. The stories are becoming darker, which I think lent itself to sort of transitioning between composers a little bit easier.
And directors. Where
they were, they were given more allowance to like take a little bit of a different approach to certain things because, you know, the movies were aging with the story. I don't know how else to say that, but makes sense. So Hedwig's theme ended up being the most well-known theme of the series, as we know, and it was used in every single film. While most other themes end up being repeated only once or twice or, like, you know, within one movie or within two or three of them. Not as much, but Hedwig's theme is in every single one. And the theme is also used in the spin-off series Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So even though it's titled Hedwig's Theme, the leitmotif relates less to the character of Hedwig and more to the overall idea of magic in the wizarding world. And I think once they established that nostalgia that they like later knew would be associated with the tune, it made sense for them to put it in and to kind of try to create that same emotional response in other spin-off movies.
Well, and if I didn't know it was Hedwig's theme, I wouldn't assume it was. It's like it's like Harry's theme almost, or like the theme of magic, you know?
Yeah, it makes more sense for it to be called Harry's theme.
Right.
But it's not. There's another one that's called...
No, it doesn't actually really make sense to call it Harry's theme because Harry, at that point, is like new to it all.
Yeah.
It's more like opening it up to him. So it's like more of like, I feel like the magical elements of the theme or whatever.
Yeah.
Which maybe can be reflected in Hedwig because Hedwig is like a companion. I don't know. It's just like, I don't think of Hedwig when I think of that song.
I don't really either, but that's what it's called. So the leitmotifs that were laid out in the first movie are also reused because it logically follows the flow of the plot lines in each movie. The early films, at least usually, all start with Harry at home with the Dursleys, then follow his travels to either the Burrow or Hogwarts, antics throughout the school, encounters with Voldemort, and an eventual return home at the end of the school year. So the repeating pattern of the books and of the movies makes sense for like certain songs to be repeated in both movies 1, 2, and 3 because we see like a similar pattern of events
cyclical.
In each of those. Cyclical, exactly. Speaking of it should be called Harry's theme and not Hedwig's theme or whatever, there is one that's called Harry's Wondrous World.
Love.
It's another leitmotif.
We were just singing it.
It's frequently repeated throughout the films. It appears in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and then again in Chamber of Secrets, Half-Blood Prince, and The Deathly Hallows Part 2. It's meant to be...
That's it.
It's not in all of them, but it is in several of them.
Yeah, especially the last one. That's interesting.
It's interesting because it's meant to be a theme that represents Harry's friendship with Ron and Hermione, and it plays during like moments of like strong bond, kind of. Yeah. So we'll play a clip of that here.
I don't know. I would say this theme is as iconic as Hedwig's theme, even though Hedwig's theme is more recognizable.
Yeah.
It's just, this is so Harry Potter, this theme. It covers a lot of bases.
Yeah. I think if you didn't know the movies and were to listen to the first one, you could guess like, oh yeah, that's Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
This one you might not know as well, but if you are a Harry Potter fan, I think it is just as iconic.
Yeah. I just feel like the other one is so specific in terms of like, this is magic, this is wonderment. Yeah. This one is literally like, you just feel like when they're all together at the end of the movie, like after they've, you know, defeated
Harry's
Voldemort
just
again.
Like caught the Remembrall in the air or whatever. That's probably a different song, but
but whatever.
Those
it's like
moments.
The same vibe. Yeah. It's those moments of triumph that this really does so well.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Another of the most recognizable and well-loved motifs from the movie is called Leaving Hogwarts. And it's a piece that plays at the end of movies 1 and 2 as Harry, appropriately, leaves Hogwarts to return to the Dursleys for the summer. The theme is not heard again in the films at all until the very end of The Deathly Hallows Part 2, where, damn it, I said this was, it made me teary when I read it, and I'm going to be teary reading it back to you now, where Harry, Ron, and Hermione watch as their children depart for Hogwarts, and the viewers of the film leave Hogwarts for the last time.
Oh, of course someone wrote that because they wanted that.
But that's exactly what it is. We hear it when Harry leaves Hogwarts and then we don't hear it ever again until the final moment of the movie.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Very emotional.
Yeah, when we leave Hogwarts. That's so cheesy. I love it. You want me to play it?
Yeah.
does he do that so well?
I don't know. He's a genius.
An absolute genius.
Yeah. So the third movie, Prisoner of Azkaban, was Williams' last one with the franchise. It takes on a slightly darker tone, both in plot and musically.
Oh, my God.
What?
Sorry, I was like, William.
Oh, Williams. Williams's. Williams's. Williams's.
I was like, excuse me? I genuinely
John
was like,
Williams's.
I had such a moment there. I was like, wait, who are we talking about?
I saw your face of confusion, and I was like, uh-oh, what did I say?
William.
John Williams, yeah. Williams. It was his last one with the franchise. It's darker, and that is reflected in the music as the changes and growth in the characters allow for a more ominous soundtrack. This is the first time, really, that we're seeing that kind of hint of darkness creep in because they've just turned 13. It's not all fun and games anymore. It's very serious. So this brings us songs like A Window to the Past, which is more of a poignant, sad, and simple melody that ties in characters who have ties to Harry's parents. And then Double Trouble, which brings in lyrics from Shakespeare's Macbeth and alludes to the idea of something wicked this way comes, foreshadowing the overall change in tone for the series.
Interesting.
Something yeah, because it's at
this
it's
way comes.
When they first arrive at Hogwarts.
Right.
Yeah.
I never thought about that. Yeah. I feel sad I never thought about that. Yeah. But I was like, oh, they're just doing a witchy thing.
Yeah.
But literally something wicked mm-hmm. this way comes.
We only sing it all the time.
Something wicked this way comes. See the cauldron boil and bake.
Okay, okay. So all of the music for the films, but particularly in Sorcerer's Stone, really emphasize the amazement and the joy that Harry finds in this new world, having only been exposed to the Muggle world previously. This is something that I think film music is so good at conveying. It very successfully tugs at the heartstrings of moviegoers, easily manipulating emotion and telling a story right along with the words of the script and the visuals of the scene, tying moments and characters together in a way that seems subtle, but in reality is an incredibly important driving force within films. It's why I think I like listening to movie scores so much, and particularly to the Harry Potter score. The music is meant to evoke emotion, it's meant to tell a story all on its own. It feels similar to the way an opera might convey an entire story through music, but without words. Music is also so strong in memory that it can convey a sense of nostalgia or comfort that we talked about for people who have strong connections to the material, like myself, and can therefore elicit emotions outside of its original intention, which I just think is cool and...
Interesting.
That's it. I don't know if I have any other points on that besides I think the reach of movie scores can go past the film itself. So the Harry Potter scores, to wrap this up, they never received any Oscars, although...
Which is so weird to think about, but also, yeah. Like, Harry Potter gets written off a lot.
It does. Well, and this is partially why. Sorcerer's Stone and Prisoner of Azkaban were both nominated, but in the year that Sorcerer's Stone was nominated, Howard Shore's score for The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, was also nominated, and Howard Shore ended up winning the Oscar that year.
Do you think that was correct?
I can't, you know what? I will say, out of all the scores I listen to Harry Potter a ton and probably equally the Lord of the Rings soundtrack. So I can't say which one is better than the other.
Lord of the Rings evokes those same emotions.
Exactly.
Too.
I think it is definitely deserving of an Oscar. Mm-hmm. Whether it's more deserving, I don't know. But mm-hmm. it definitely deserved its Oscar. That's what I'll say about it.
That's all I'll say about it.
Yeah. So Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban, Half-Blood Prince, and Deathly Hallows Part 2 were all nominated for Grammys, but also never won. So they've at least been acknowledged in the nominations, but they never won any awards.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I know. I think it's crazy, but...
I know. The influence is still there. Yeah. At the same time, you're like,
Yeah.
You're only as good as your best competition. And that just happened to be Howard Shore.
Yeah, I guess. It's fine. He didn't need any more Oscars. He was literally so many.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so, I mean, I feel like the legacy holds so much more weight than an Oscar.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's what, an award? It's just an award? Means nothing.
Plastic.
Yeah, is that plastic? The Oscars are plastic.
I mean, they're not.
They're not.
If you listened to our Oscars episode.
they're not. We did do an awards episode.
Yeah, we did. Wow. Just award things. That was a while ago. I talked about the old Oscar dude.
Yeah. Well, that's what I have for you on Harry Potter. I talked a lot about it because...
Good. I was there for... I share those same feelings about the score of Harry Potter with you. And just like, yeah, I'm not as big of a Harry Potter fan. But I will say that those scores, like... It's 100% like such a vibe.
It is a vibe. It's a vibe, and it does exactly what it's supposed to do, which is create an emotional response.
Exactly. So. It's why I wanted to do Spirited Away, because like those same vibes I get from that movie of like you hear One Summer's Day, those first literal piano plunks, and you're like...
Yeah, another very simple da-da-da opening.
It's like a sense of home, you know? And it's so funny because like One Summer's Day is attached to the beginning of the movie, and it's it. They're driving in a car... You know, she's moving to a new place. Mm-hmm. It's very scary. It's very hard.
But it's another, like, very simple opening that, like, perfectly sets what the tone of the movie
is going to be. Yeah. Because it's a little, there's a little minor in it, you know? And, so it's so funny. Like, One Summer's Day doesn't come back. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's not a repeating motif, but it's so, like, of the movie just from that opening.
Yeah.
And, speaking of nostalgia, I didn't talk about this. You know, I could have gushed about Spirited Away. But... That same vibe, like, when you're thinking of, like, this, even though it occurs at the beginning, like, that's probably the part of the movie you watch the most. Like, maybe you don't make it through the movie, but, like, you think about the opening and the first thing you saw and what it means and, So I get why, like, Hedwig's theme, same example. It's like, you know, is it the first thing you hear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, on the soundtrack, it's called Prologue, but it's the exact same opening as the piece that's titled Hedwig's theme.
Exactly. So it's like the first thing you hear, it was like the start of the magic, and it just elicits those same feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it.
Nerds.
Can't wait to go a different direction. The composer I'm talking about today is no surprise.
Oh.
It's Thomas Newman.
Yay! Yes. Oh, I'm so glad. I really do love Thomas Newman.
Thomas Newman in... What I had said earlier, the comment I had made about, like, the timeline of music composing film history is, in my eyes and probably many eyes, like, the bridge between, like, older musical composition and, like, modern composition.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
like, modern composition is so electronic and so, you know, besides people who like to live in the... old, you know, like, the orchestral land, like, Thomas Newman is kind of, like, in my opinion, the in-between.
Okay.
Like, some of his stuff is... Well, because he was born... I'm getting ahead. Because he was born and started composing in the time that you had said that, like, the digital age was happening in the 80s, it was, like, he was on the cusp of that.
Is he that young?
No. He was working in the 80s.
Okay. I was like, no way.
No, he was born in 1955.
Okay. Checks out. I think Thomas Newman... did one of my favorite movie soundtracks, which is Little Women from the 90s.
He did.
Ugh.
Nominated for an Oscar.
I love that soundtrack. Again, because it's like nostalgia things.
Yeah.
Because it came out in the 90s. I think I probably watched it with my family when I was like 10 or whatever.
Right.
But it's, yeah, I love that soundtrack.
That's so funny. Yeah, Thomas Newman.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yes. Okay.
And Finding Nemo, right?
Finding Nemo.
Oh, he's so good. Okay, tell me about it.
Finding Nemo, Little Women, Shawshank Redemption, 1917, a more recent one, Green Mile, Road to Perdition, The Help, Skyfall, The Iron Lady, unstoppable
what?
Amount of
what?
Films.
Literally. What a list.
That literally is, like, not even all of the, like, most popular ones.
Yeah.
I just chose from the most popular
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's just, like, he's just got it, you know? When you got it, you got it.
He's just this guy. Oh, he's just got it. I thought he said he's just this guy.
Oh, no.
He's just got it.
In fact, he's not just this guy. This is not like some rags to riches story. He came from like not only money, but also music composition legacy. Alfred Newman was the name of his father.
Yes.
And his father was a composer who worked on like a little bit of old Hollywood because of the age difference or whatever, and won 9 Academy Awards.
Was he a studio composer? Is that why?
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah, 9.
That's a lot.
And not only that, he was so influential that, you know, that little old tune that was the 20th Century Fox fanfare?
Yeah.
He wrote it.
Oh my God.
That was Alfred Newman.
Oh my God.
Thomas's father.
Thomas's father. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Wow, those like musical genius genes were strong.
I know, which is so interesting because with Thomas Newman, it never occurred to him to be a music composer.
Really?
Yeah. His mom forced all the children into lessons,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like I'm going to follow my father's legacy,
mm-hmm.
until he turned 14 years old and his dad died.
Oh.
Oh, because his dad had him old.
He was old.
Yeah, I think he was literally 55.
God.
When he had Thomas Newman.
Wow, yeah.
So Thomas, in later interviews, was like, his father was never really a father figure at that point because he had passed that point, you know? And he was saying, too, that, like, his father would go into a room somewhere and, like, occasionally he'd hear, like, a little bit of plunking. And that was it. It wasn't like he heard, like, sweeping piano and various compositions still being made or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, wasn't about that. It was a musical family. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But, like, that wasn't the vibe until his dad died. And then somehow he was, like, I don't know what. He didn't really explain in an interview. It was just, like, that's how he kind of found his way into composing.
Wow.
After the death of his dad.
Wow.
Now let me talk about the rest of his family.
Okay.
Filled with people. His uncle, Lionel Newman, did the scoring for, like, movie musicals in the mid-1900s. Like, Hello, Dolly.
Yeah.
And he won an Academy Award for that.
What?
Yeah. He didn't write the music for Hello, Dolly. They did the movie scoring for it. His other uncle, Emil Newman, also worked in old Hollywood films as well. Various music departments, various awards. His brother, David Newman, wrote the score for Anastasia. Not the music. The score.
Okay. I was going to say the animated movie that I love so very much.
The animated movie that you love so much. But not like the... But, you know, there's a difference.
But not like the pop songs in it.
Exactly. Yeah. Not like the Journey to the Past. He didn't write that. He also wrote Matilda, Mighty Ducks, Brave Little Toaster, Ice Age.
Stop.
Like, those are all the same.
Ice Age.
The vibe that David gave. And this was his older brother, too, so if that says anything about you being the younger brother. And then his younger sister, Maria Newman, had a long, like, performance career. Was a composer, but more of a composer of, like, legit orchestral music.
Okay.
Not film score music.
Okay.
Yeah. So the whole family was literally this. So Thomas Newman grew up with this legacy and studied music composition and orchestration at the University of Southern California. Oh, did I say he was born in L.A. because his father worked in Hollywood?
No, but I feel like you didn't have to say that.
No, I didn't.
It was pretty clear.
Anyway, he went to University of Southern California and then transferred to Yale to get a B.A. in 1977 and a master's in 1978. While at Yale, he met Stephen Sondheim, who became a mentor. Not like you're going to come work on... Okay, so I read a couple things that said he worked on Broadway musicals. I don't think that was the case. I think what happened was that Sondheim kind of took him under his wing and helped him, like, coach, kind of, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, here's what we're going for kind of stuff. Not like a, come work on this, like, West Side Story with me.
Was
you know?
Sondheim, like, teaching at Yale at that point?
19?
He, like...
No, because,
associate
like...
Associate professoring in the 70s?
I didn't look that far, but...
That's fine. I'm just curious.
I mean, he was...
What he was doing there.
He was big in the 80s.
Yeah, but Sondheim started working on musical theater stuff, like, in the 50s. Like, he worked on West Side Story.
That's right.
Yeah. So he would have already been...
I almost forget. It's that old.
Yeah. He's... Well, he's dead now, but he was... He was really old.
Yeah, so must have been, like, an associate professor. Anyway, don't know. How Thomas Newman got his big break is exactly what we could guess. Family connections.
Nepotism.
A little old man by the name of John Williams, as Bree had said earlier, was a friend of his father and uncle, and asked Thomas to come work on Return of the Jedi to score the music for when Darth Vader dies.
Oh, wow. Big moment.
Huge. Huge.
I love this connection.
I know, right? So perfect. Silly. So silly. Afterwards, he met Scott Rudin, who asked him to compose music for Reckless in 1984. And this is his first feature film. So this is kind of like, oh, I'm going to get my like start. And I finally, you know, I've worked with Stephen Sondheim. I've worked with Scott Rudin. I've worked with John Williams. You know, like, I'm going to have a big career, a big long career. Mm-hmm. But what happened was is that he couldn't really find his voice in this stuff. Because, you know, as I said, he's the bridge between old and new. I think what was happening was he was trying to exist within what was established in the old.
Yeah.
And having a hard time being in that thing. Yeah. It wasn't quite, like, working out for him. And so it took him 8 years.
So what's fascinating about that is when you listed all of his movies, I was like, wow, Thomas Newman can really change it up. Like, he can create so many different sounds and like soundscapes of things. And you saying he had a hard time finding his voice is interesting because it seems like that serves him later. Yeah.
It really does. And he hadn't found it yet. I think too, like later, I'll talk about that later. So that was happening, but he did find his voice in 1994, baby, with 2 Academy Award nominations. One already mentioned, Little Women, and the other one, Shawshank Redemption. Ooh, yeah, sing
that's
for
Little
us.
Women.
Oh. Sure. I mean, that sounds like him. I don't really know the Little Women soundtrack. I'm not gonna lie. These 2 films being nominated at the same time, like, was a humbling moment, but also, like, kind of made him popular.
I was gonna say, humbling? Being nominated for 2 Academy Awards at once was humbling?
What do I mean? What do I mean with that?
I don't know what you mean.
It was like, I think when you have, like, that much success at once, or it didn't get to him. I think it was kind of one of those moments where he's just like, wow, like, I'm so grateful to be here.
Okay.
Where I am. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
By, like, humbling. It's like it took me this long to find
it,
and I found it.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Or whatever. And then he lost to another person, Hans Zimmer.
Who's heard of him?
Right. Wrote The Lion King. And so The Lion King won the Academy Award that year, but doesn't matter. I have to say right now, I'll take this opportunity to say, Thomas Newman has 15 nominations and 0 wins. Has not won 1 Academy Award.
He will. I feel it. I believe in you, Thomas.
I feel like he's already made his iconic soundtracks, but who can say?
How old is he? Not that old. He has time.
He was born in 1955.
John Williams is 90 years old. He has time.
Okay. But did John Williams already create his best stuff?
Maybe, but he, like, just scored the newest Star Wars movie, like, not that many years ago, and he was, like, late 80s.
Was it really good?
It was really good. It was building on what he had already done, though, right. So, but, listen, I believe in him.
Whatever. So what movie am I talking about today?
What? Which movie?
A little film called American Beauty.
Ah, of course you are.
Bree and I, the first year at Oakland University, have a history with American Beauty.
We do.
Not only because we had watched it, which I think we've actually talked about on this podcast before.
We might have. I feel like, weirdly, this story comes up all the time. Maybe because it was the first time we hung out with, like, a small group. It was, like, you, me, and our friend Jake.
I think that's what it was. We talked about it the very first episode.
It was, like, beginning of
our friendship.
Yeah.
So that's why this is, like, I was kind of wanting to keep it a surprise because it's kind of, like, a special moment.
Yeah.
But also, like, not a soundtrack that I'm, like, I love American Beauty.
It is so good, though.
It's Thomas Newman to a T, which is why I'm talking about it. Because if all the Newmanisms exist in a film, it's American Beauty. So it's a perfect one to talk about. I want to talk about Shawshank Redemption. It's just not as iconic as American Beauty. And the reason I also want to talk about American Beauty is because it also explains what makes, like, the tension that exists in American Beauty explains what makes Thomas Newman a genius. I'll say it.
Ooh.
A genius. I forgot to mention, too, another connection that Brie and I have. I'm all over the place. With American Beauty is we did our very first movement class. Our teacher, Lene LaFelt, would play two of the songs that I'm actually going to talk about.
Good.
So you'll be able to hear them in this. And we would do viewpoints to them.
Yes. Oh, viewpoints. Oh, my God. What a throwback.
What a throwback.
If you're a theater person and you ever did viewpoints, you know.
You would know American Beauty is great viewpoint.
Send us
music.
An email. Tell us about your viewpoints right. experience.
I think about podcasts at gmail.com. Okay, so American Beauty, coming off the success of Shawshank and Little Women, Newman never expected the music of American Beauty to be iconic. It wasn't like a, oh, like, this is my big break. It's not like a, I have to take this chance. You know, like, he already had the success. There was no pressure. And I had said earlier, too, like, when people score music, they're not like, this is going to be a hit.
Yeah.
It's like what fits the story.
Yeah.
Which you talked about in Exhaustion.
And American Beauty is a weird movie.
Yeah.
So it could be that he looked at it and was like, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to be popular or not.
Yeah. It was also the director, Sam Mendes's first film.
Oh.
Too. And it started their long career, like, which extends to 1917, just a year ago.
Yeah.
So they have worked
on... The movie 1917.
Oh, yeah. The movie 1917.
Yeah.
If it wasn't clear. Just a year ago, it was 1918. Yeah. So they, like, this definitely, if that gives any hint, is, like, this was the start of a great friendship. But he was just doing a job at this movie. In American Beauty, the reason we get Thomas to his perfect self is because he was very open to creativity within this film. And one of the things that happens is in the opening monologue, he has these unique percussion instruments, which is true for the whole movie. It's like all about percussion. And one of the things that happened was that Mike Fisher, which was the percussionist, pulled out a tabla, which is a pair of twin drums used in India. And Thomas Newman was like, let's see what that sounds like. And that kind of creativity and playfulness fits the score so well. And working with Sam Mendes, Sam was always like, what does that sound there? You know, like, oh, I want to hear that again. That's how those, like, kind of themes would
that's
continue.
So cool.
And repeat themselves in a way.
Yeah.
In particular, Thomas said that Sam had a very, all these first names, whatever. Newman said that Mendes had a huge part in the American Beauty soundtrack because he had listened to another thing that Thomas Newman had created, which was Unsung Heroes, and he loved the, like, percussive rhythm sounds that it had and wanted that kind of vibe for American Beauty.
Yeah. Did Thomas Newman do Jumanji by any chance?
No.
Okay. I'm thinking about percussion.
No.
Okay.
He's a soul. Any percussion.
Any percussion.
Ever made.
Is the same person and it's all Jumanji.
Not Jumanji again. Don't bring it back. Thomas Newman liked incorporating other instruments like the zither, the hurdy-gurdy.
My favorite.
The psaltery. I've never heard of that and I didn't look it up. And the hammered dulcimer.
Oh.
Which is, you know what that is?
I have heard of a dulcimer.
Yeah, it's like a long, like, there's a wooden board with a bunch of strings on it, metal strings, and you use, like, little hammer like a piano to play it. Every time he does a project, he spends time away with the instrumentalist to, like, play instead of, like, working on the task. So he's like, instead of thinking about American Beauty, he's like, I'm going to go with the instrumentalist, we're just going to play.
Let's just jam.
It's literally a jam session.
Jam session.
Literally. Before, like, the actual work had to be done. And so this was, like, so important, and, you know, it keeps, like, a lot of Thomas Newman's music is very playful. It's very, like, it's just, like,
lots of ups
fun,
and, downs.
And there's some, like, somber, obviously. But,
sure.
But, like, that's kind of how that comes about. He also said that he has an interest, and I love this quote, an interest in mundane experimentation.
Does he elaborate at all on that?
Okay. But what's interesting about this specific quote, and I'm going to play a piece of music, is that you can hear it in the opening scene with Lester Burnham. He's talking about in less than a year, he's going to die. And this is the music that plays.
Oh my God.
The mundane experimentation. So the music in this scene, it brought us back to viewpoint.
It did.
Listening to it.
The music in this scene is so important because not only is it kind of like, you know, one of those things where it's like, there's tension with what's actually being said.
Yeah.
But what's happening is that Lester's having a monologue. He's like, you know, he's talking about his wife. He's talking about himself. Mm-hmm. He's talking about his wife. And he's talking like how her, you know, she's clipping the flowers in the yard and the clippers match her shoes. Mm-hmm. And then the wife has a conversation with the neighbors. And then he's talking about the neighbors. And then he's talking about the wife and the neighbors. And as he's talking about it, he's staring through the window like a creep, like from inside the house. While they're having just a nice, pleasant conversation. Yeah. He's literally having the worst day of his life, but it's a normal day.
Yeah.
And then he talks about his daughter and stuff like that. And it's basically setting up a stasis of this, like, what's going to become a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Like, this mundane existence that Lester has in his life. And what makes this music so important is that it literally repeats the same exact, like, thing over and over again. That do, 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 pause, 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 do, 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 do. It's like him reliving the same day over and over and over again. Even when he's just explaining one particular morning to himself.
Yeah.
That's why the music, like, does that repetition.
Yeah, it's just like, and it's kind of like cheery too. So like what he's witnessing other people do is like a cheery interaction, but he himself, it's mundane.
It's like an awful day.
Yeah.
So it's just like you could think about like what type of music you would write for that thing.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about kind of that tension later too. It's just like what is happening from the get-go.
I love the thought process of like, how do we create this moment?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And literally he just had to play.
Yeah.
Play, because you never really know until you're like, oh, like, what's that? Like, let's do that again. That kind of is interesting with what we're viewing.
Yeah.
You know? Because another big thing about Thomas Newman is that he thinks bad music is when you're repeating what's happening. Like, when you're not adding anything new. To him, he wants to look at what's on the screen and enlighten you into something deeper.
Oh, interesting.
In just what you're seeing. Because otherwise, you're just, it's redundant.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so his thing is always, like, he wants to create something that kind of makes you think more deeper. It's like subtext or something like that. And my favorite line from that opening is, my wife and daughter think I'm a loser. They're right, of course. It's just so, like, matter of fact, because he's been so accepting, like, of his life.
That sounds like a midlife crisis.
It literally does.
Oh, my God.
And so these repetitions and stuff like that, Thomas Newman said that in later interviews that his music is static and repetitive, but not in a bad way.
Mm.
It's on purpose. It allows the story to come through. And this is, like, the perfect, it's a literal example, like, there's literally repetition.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, in general, we had said when we were doing those viewpoints in class, that sounded like Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
You know? But to him, it doesn't really matter if, like, oh, this sounds exactly like something I've composed before. It's all about, like, what's going to help the story.
Yeah,
and if it's the same thing, it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, like, if it's repetitive, you're not listening to the music. You're not like, oh, my God, I really love the way this orchestra is working. It's like, no, I'm listening to a story and there just happens to be this thing playing.
Yeah, well, and we had just talked about how that's not like a lot of composers experience that. Mm-hmm. When you're creating like a signature sound, so to speak, there might be moments of repetition. We were talking when we were on a short break about how Marion's Theme by John Williams, written for
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Written for Raiders of the Lost Ark, sounds very similar to Princess Leia's theme from Star Wars. And I was like scrolling on Reddit and there have been like a bunch of things of, like, oh yeah, this thing from this John Williams movie sounds a lot like this thing from this other John Williams movie. Because he's one man
who
like pulls from similar references and has a specific writing style.
And for John, that evokes the same emotion.
Yeah.
It's not like a, oh, let me pull from this theme because it kind of reminds me. It's like, no, this Princess Leia, or, you know, I guess it was probably the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Marion, you know, gives me this vibe. And it just, like, I'm not thinking about Princess Leia. I'm just like, this is the vibe I get. It just happens to be similar.
Right, right. Yeah, so repetition is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, can be good. Example. On the opposite end, this is kind of the tension. He tries to stay very practical. And this can be done with simplicity and pacing. We kind of already got simplicity and pacing in the opening. You know, it's like a movement of drums and stuff like that, like walking through life. And it's very simple. It's the repeating same pattern. But we also get this in the plastic bag scene, which is when Ricky, who is one of the characters, who ends up dating Lester's daughter. Mm-hmm. That's the connection if you haven't watched the movie. He's like a filmmaker, and he films this plastic bag, and he's kind of talking about how, the quote is, "Sometimes there's so much beauty in the world, I feel like I can't take it, and my heart is going to cave in."
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because the scene itself, I mean, the movie's like kind of like a dark comedy, but the scene itself is like, he's filming a plastic bag and he's talking about beauty in the world, like just floating. It's so like film major, and it's yeah. very silly, but why the music is so important in this scene is that it's so like simple and beautiful and haunting
mm-hmm.
that it's helping you see the beauty and the intensity of the scene, not like the, like if it was the do underneath like the right. scene, it would be like a comedy, but instead it's like, no, you need to listen to what he's actually saying.
Yeah.
And so he creates this like slow, speaking of rhythm, slow, like ambient kind of like, not drone,
mm-hmm.
but like vibe,
mm-hmm.
vibes, and then has this like very slow repeating piano theme
oh.
that goes over top of it. And I'll play it now so you can
yes,
hear.
Yes, please.
And then we can talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, imagine that, like, while you're just, like, they're just sitting on the edge of the bed watching this video that this guy made, you know?
Yeah.
And the title of that song is American Beauty.
Yeah.
So, it carries the weight of the name of the whole movie.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's, like, this is the theme of the movie, it's, right. like, very important for the whole overarching theme of the movie. Because, essentially, you know, this guy's living his life and it's boring. And, you know, everyone's kind of a main character of this movie. I'm just talking about Lester, but... like, they're all kind of, like, going through life, da-da-da. And they all kind of have this change
mm-hmm.
that exists in the movie. Because, obviously, you have to have an inciting incident. And so, they all change as characters or whatever. And are starting to see different things and the beauty yeah. of life, essentially.
Like,
and
beauty in the small things.
The beauty in small things and the large things, I guess, sometimes or whatever. It's like, I mean, I'll talk about it later.
Yeah, I'm going to have to rewatch this movie. I
literally should have watched it for this so I could explain it better, but this is not an analysis of American Beauty.
Yeah.
But it does help talk about, like, kind of the music.
Yeah.
So that music itself helps pace, as I said earlier, the scene now that you've heard it. And even Sam Mendes, like, emphasized this well, that music is so important for pacing and rhythm specifically,
mm-hmm.
because we know that that scene now is a serious scene.
Right.
That music is so serious.
Yeah.
And so simple. Like, it doesn't have to be this, like, overwhelming orchestration. Not that I don't love everything that John Williams creates,
mm-hmm.
but, like, I couldn't imagine what he would have played for that scene, you know, or whatever.
Right.
Like, you know, it would be like some of that. And so to have just something that's very simple is nice. And that helps the transition to modern composers is like someone I wanted to do, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. A lot of their stuff is like very simple, like droning tones
mm-hmm.
with like some beats or some like simple melodies on top
mm-hmm.
that repeat, which is kind of like makes me think of like influence from Thomas Newman.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. And it is, it's so, I don't know. It's just very interesting how something that simple can have the same sort of effect as maybe a grander sweeping song, but it's like, it dictates the tone of the moment.
That's such a great point though,
mm-hmm.
that it can, even though it's so simple,
mm-hmm.
have similar feelings.
Yeah.
And I mean, that song on Spotify, so I just played it, has 33 million listens. So it's like,
yeah.
it's not an unpopular song. it's like probably the most popular on the album, I think. So he can play like all he wants and have creativity and stuff like that. But to him, like, it has to be practical and fit the story that mm-hmm. is being told. When he's writing for music for a movie, he says that image tells him whether or not a piece is false or true. Which I think is so interesting. You don't think about that. Like, you may have an idea of what you want this image that you're viewing silent to sound like, but then when you put it up against the image, it's going to let you know, like, this isn't correct, or it rings true. So it's like so interesting that he says that. And specifically for American Beauty, he believed that the score like fit the film without disturbing what he called the moral ambiguity of the script, and saying that it was a real delicate balancing act in terms of what music worked to preserve that. Because as we know, or maybe you don't, American Beauty is kind of like a tough, you know, TUFF film, because a major plot point in the inciting incident, spoilers, is when Lester sees his daughter's friend.
Yeah.
And is sexually attracted to her. And that's what sparks the whole movie. It changes his relationship with his wife and his daughter. Mm-hmm. And they all change along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes, you know, his neighbors, who is also Ricky's father. Like, he goes through some stuff that changes their whole family.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all, like, I mean, obviously it culminates in his death, as I had spoiled. He says it at the very beginning of the movie. but it's like that brings his whole family to the change of stuff. And so that's why kind of the tension exists as well, because he saw the stuff that was being said and needed to support that.
Yeah, it's a subject you want to treat delicately.
Very.
Yeah.
Because it is pedophilia at the base.
Yep.
And to support that, this is the music that, and you'll kind of get like the vibe that Thomas Newman creates for the scenes in which Lester visualizes, Angela is her name, the attraction?
Sure.
The potential sexual energy?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's where the iconic rose petals come from, because there's a scene in which he's looking up from his bed and she's above him in a pool of rose petals and they're falling on him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the whole, you know, the whole vibe or whatever. But this is the kind of one of the themes that plays. I mean, it is the theme, but it's one of the versions that plays when she is being fantasized. That's the word I wanted. So, well, I think a couple things interesting about this piece.
Yeah.
Is one, the first thing I think of is, you know, those little bell balls of like you get at Chinese gift shops.
Yeah.
That you jingle. That's the first thing I hear.
Yeah.
Which those are supposed to be like mental. It's all about like clearing your energy.
I was going to say it sounds like a wind chime, but that is a better example.
But also not a bad second example, because wind chimes itself are kind of like this ethereal like.
Yeah, there's sort of like a floaty bell sound.
Yeah, because it's essentially a daydream is what he's having with this, when these songs are playing.
Yeah.
And weird, surreal things are happening, like rose petals and stuff like that falling. And that's interesting. And then the other interesting thing is that, like, did you hear that random, like, whirring? Like the whee.
I heard like a whee.
Yeah, literally, which
like
sounds
a
like
siren.
A siren, like, which is a bad thing, or like mechanical, which is like a very, like, I don't know, like his brain. Someone described it in like a little video I watched as his brain kind of like working, like struggling.
Yeah.
You know, like that's why it sounds kind of like mechanical.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I was going to say too, hearing that, it's not a comfortable song.
No.
That's not like easy listening, which makes sense with the theme and the subject matter and what you as a audience members may be supposed to feel watching this is like, this is wrong and it's uncomfortable that he's like having this vision of this girl.
Because you're not meant, it's not meant to be a sweeping love theme.
Right.
That he's viewing this girl. It's meant to be like a, what
it's
am
like,
I?
Uh-oh, there's something weird happening.
There's something weird happening. And so again, fits with the whole Thomas Newman, like it, we need to comment on what's happening, but support it.
Mm-hmm.
And not like, have tension with the moral ambiguity or whatever.
Right, because the character himself could be feeling that way too. Of
100%.
Like, what's happening? I don't understand. This is a confusing image and also sound.
Right, and I want it, but also like,
but also,
it's bad that I want it.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been, you know, not sleeping with my wife, you know, and so, yeah. And what's interesting too, spoiler again, is that later when, so there's a couple of these visions throughout the movie, later when they actually get together and she's like, I'm a virgin, I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It that doesn't play.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
It's not like, it's not like a, here's the climax of it. It's like meant to be disappointing.
Huh.
Because one, he doesn't get what he wants.
Yeah.
And once he finds out she's a virgin, he immediately sees her as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Which mm-hmm. ruins the fantasy, but also, like, smacks reality in his face. This whole movie has been him being like, this is my new thing, and I'm going to work. He starts working out for it. Mm-hmm. He starts treating his family different
for
it.
Well, his life is boring, so he's living in a fantasy.
Living the fantasy.
Yeah.
And the fantasy turns out to be bad, yeah. you know? And he's like, this is a child.
Yeah.
Like, that I was my daughter's friend.
Ugh.
That I was, like, wanting to kiss, yeah. you know, and, like, hook up with. Or
fascinating.
Whatever. Yeah. We'll have to rewatch the movie. Definitely. Because, like, maybe we'll rewatch it and be like, oh, no, he still kind of wanted her. But, like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the vibe. Very interesting. That song is called Root Beer.
Okay.
Because, well, he first sees her at, like, the cheer competition.
Uh-huh.
Or not. It's, like, a cheer in the middle of a game or something. But that is when she's like, oh, you have... He's looking in the fridge. And she's like, oh, you have root beer in the fridge? It's just over. They're all there. They're mm-hmm. all in the room, you know? But he's having this vision about wanting to get with her. And in the thing, she's like reaches up to him and it repeats three times, like her moving her arm up
mm-hmm.
and then like goes up his shoulder and then he pulls her in a kiss.
Oh.
And then it cuts and she has the root beer on the other side of the room. So he was just having a vision while his whole family was there and they're all like looking at him
what
weird.
What is wrong
like,
with you, Dad? Yeah.
Why? Yeah.
Oh
so
my God.
Haunting. But like another good example of like, helping you understand what you're supposed to be feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yeah. So these tensions, the creativity of trying new instruments and repeating motifs and practicality of what works with the images are what I think makes Thomas Newman a genius. Because then it's not about the story. Kilby. Because it is about the story and not about a look at what amazing music and what amazing theme I created for this movie.
Yeah.
That's it.
Wow. I love it. That's fascinating. I feel like we like fully geeked out on this episode about like what music can create. But yeah. that's what's so cool about it is that like it's not just like easy listening or I like this song or whatever. Like the whole point that humans enjoy music
right.
is that it makes you feel something, whether right. that's like a happy or a sad emotion or oh, this is wrong or whatever, like right. excitement about discovering magic or there's so many different ways that it can make you feel and mm-hmm. it also like in its own way lets you picture things like if there wasn't a movie there already
right
the music helps you envision something that's happening and
that's
so it's
not
like
there. Yeah.
It's like a perfect marriage of media.
Marriage. I love
marriage. Yeah well thank you Josh
mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for listening.
No, thank you.
Feel free to send us a message at thingamabobpodcast@gmail.com or slide into our DMs on Instagram at thingamabobpodcast or on Twitter at thingamabobpod. While you're there, give us a follow and please subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. Please leave us a review. It really helps us show up on the iTunes charts and the new and recommended page. Special thanks to our Patreon producers and co-producers, Emma is Cooler Than Josh, Alex F., Number One Fan Nicole, and Fox Queen 22. Make sure to join us next week where we talk about all things thingamabob.
And thank you so much for joining us because now we are all two things smarter.